Well, when I look back on some of the instances, I'll call them instances, which led me to finish up doing exactly what I wanted to do in life. I was about 11 years old when I was supposed to be I was the only son of a farmer, and obviously I was expected to continue on the farming tradition. He was a very good farmer. I had no interest in it whatsoever. I didn't mind the work, I didn't mind the hard work, but I just wasn't interested in it. And about 11, when I was about 11, I looked inside a radio and I got religion.
So whereabouts were you living? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in 28 miles out of a place called Meriden in Western Australia, and the depression was still on, and things were really tough, and they had no, of course, no school buses in those days, and we had to do everything by correspondence, and the correspondence lessons came second to farm work. So when there was something that had to be done, lessons just were left beside the wayside, and we were expected to go. And to be honest, I've never been inside a school from my primary school days.
So what did you see when you looked inside the radio?
Just the sight of the valves. And of course, it was going. It was one of those old-time radios where you could lift the lid off and look down on it, and to see all the filaments alight and these mysterious-looking valves, I thought, this is magic. And it led me to become totally besotted with it. And I read everything, and I, as the farming community found that I was a bit interested in radio, they would say, "Oh, Kev, I've got an old wireless you can have." Oh, heaven. The only person that wasn't interested in was Dad. And I made a microphone. I was always trying something out. I made a microphone out of the center carbon rod of a A-type 1.5 volt cell
Oh, yes.
they use in telephones. And first off, I'd read about carbon mics, and so I made one with carbon from a battery in a matchbox, and with a sheet of tinfoil over the top. But that didn't work very well because I knew what was supposed to do, but the carbon granules were too fine and I was packing up. So I broke one of these cells, the carbon rod. Broke the rod, and I thought, now this has got a very uneven surface, and I put a piece of, if I put a piece of tin foil, garnered from an old tea chest across, and the whole thing was held in place by a piece of wood that I'd whittled out, a deal box, and so I could move the rod in and out to get the thing. And of course, when I spoke, it sounded like Donald Duck, but it, nevertheless, you could understand what I was saying.
But it worked.
It worked, and I was so thrilled about this, and I had. One night I was out in my little room that I had, and I managed to get enough wire to go into the kitchen, which was our living area, and my mother was darning socks, and Dad was reading the paper, and I said, "Oh, Mum, I made a microphone," Oh, no, I didn't even tell her it was a microphone. I said, listen to this, Mum. And I said, so she put on the headphones and I went back out of sight to see her. And I said, hello, Mum. Mum, I was watching her. She nearly fell, jumped out of her chair. She said, oh. I went in and I said, I made a microphone, Mum. And she said, oh. And she turned to my father and who said, she said, Kev's made a microphone. You have a listen. So I was very pleased about this. I was hoping that I would impress him. And I said, hello, Dad. Dead silence. He just took off the headphone to pass them back to Mum and said, went on reading his paper. It sort of dampened my enthusiasm, but I was determined. And anyway, that was what started it all. And then through a rather strange set of circumstances, I finally found my way from the farm to a grocery board and working in an old grocery shop where you weighed up sugar and cut butter and all that kind of stuff, and to actually repairing radios, to doing photography, because I was very interested in, and still interested in photography. And
where did you end up repairing radios?
Well, that came about in a rather strange manner, because I was working away at this grocery shop. I'll never forget that I was cleaning out the refrigerator. It was one of those jobs that everybody hated, and we used to draw lots for it, and I always lost somehow or other. And I think I was cheated somewhere, but anyway. And this guy who owned a hardware shop came in and he said, oh, cool. You know something about wireless, don't you? And I said, oh, a little bit, Mr. Lecky. And he said, how would you like to come and work for me? And I said, I couldn't see the relationship there. He said, oh, I've got a chance of getting the STC dealership. But the requirement is that I have somebody who can repair radios. And he said, if you come and work with me, he said, they will take you down in you can go to Perth, which was 160 odd miles away, and said, and you can go and work in their repair shop for a while and, you know, get to know some of the ropes, because I had been fixing wirelesses and in there so that's what I did. I almost jumped the fridge at that stage of the game and said, come on, let's go.
A great opportunity.
What a great opportunity. But the only problem was that a couple of years later, I was about 18, I think, he sold the business, and the people that took over the business were not in any way, shape or form suited to that kind of business. And it was just heading straight for the rocks like that, that cruise ship. And a friend of mine who was the photographer in the town came in to knew things weren't going too well. And he said, hey, you know, You've got photography as a hobby, and you've been fixing wirelesses. How about you come and work for me, and you can make radio your hobby? And I thought, oh, well, that was a better way than knowing that the shop was going to fold, which it did eventually, a short time later. So for 18 months, I suppose, I worked in the dark room and very rarely saw the light of day. But he, the photographer, was a very erratic sort of a person, and a good photographer, but had no business sense. And I'd be working away in the dark, and they said, "What are you doing in there?" I'd say, "Oh, I'm just printing so-and-so's order." "Oh, look, it's lovely outside. Come on, we'll go and see if we can take some photos." So at 19 or whatever I was then, 18, 19, I was only too happy to get out in the sunshine. So we'd go out there, and I'd come back, and they'd get back about 4:30. Okay, off I'd go back in the dark room, and 5:30, I'd come out, and he said, "Did you finish the order?" I said, "No." He said, "Well, where are you going?" I said, "I'm going home having dinner. I've got to go out tonight." Very taken aback. And I said, "Well, I've got it. The appointment's been made." So that went on for a while, and I became quite ill because it was a very stressful time because there was the dark room was virtually homemade. There were no timers. You had to count ABC1, ABC2, and to get the amount of time that you needed for developing it. And finally, I went down pretty sick.
Yeah.
So while I was lying in bed, I thought, well, this isn't much fun. And it wasn't working out as well as I thought it would. I still like photography, but I love radio more. So I said, I'm not going to work here anymore. But where was I going from there? I was the only son. And so I went back and spoke to my father. Said, "Hey, if I were to go and work for my brother-in-law for 12 months and on the farm, and you felt that I was doing okay, what about I come back on the farm?" "Oh, okay." That was very non-committal. I went back, and after, I forget how long, 18 months, I suppose, working in this dark room, you can just imagine how soft my hands were. I went straight out, and he was contract scrub rolling. I found myself driving a modified General Grant tank, slightly different to working in the quiet of a dark room.
Yes. Pretty hard work.
Various things happened. But the more I was there, the more I hated it, you know? I had no feeling for it. I could walk right past a job without even knowing that it needed doing. But one day, I was getting into Meriden as often as I could because I was very friendly with my future wife, and we played a lot of tennis. And the house that my father bought was in a cross street, and across, diagonally opposite, there was my idol. He was the supervising technician of the PMG.
Right.
And I used to watch him. Sometimes he'd ride a bike, sometimes he had a little old car, but he'd go off in his highly starched dust coat off to work, and I'd see them come in when I was working in the main street. See them come in at evening hour, having been out fixing things. And I thought, "Oh, my God, just to be doing that. Oh, wouldn't that be?" And he had a wife, a lovely wife, and two kids. And most impressive of all, he was a ham radio operator.
Right.
And that's what I wanted to do. I was studying for it. And I was learning Morse code by listening to Morse on the shortwave. Anyway, this particular day we were playing tennis together in doubles. And we came up and it was hot and we were just sitting together and we started talking. And he was a man that was talking on different subjects, like, "Oh, it hasn't rained for the last couple of weeks, it'll all be ruined. And the sheep need shearing and this need doing." But he was talking other things. And after we'd been talking for a little while, he became very restive. And I thought, "I've got to keep him. I must." And the words came out of my mouth without me even thinking of it. I said, "Oh, when did you join the PMG? He said, "Oh, about 12 years ago." And I knew how old he was, and that was at the same age as I was then, at that instant. And I said, "Oh, how did you join the PMG?" "Oh, I became an adult tech in training." "Oh," I said. I asked him a few more questions. He said, "Are you interested?" "Huh." I'm drowning. Somebody's throwing me a lifeline. "Was I interested in grabbing hold of it?" I said, "Oh, yes, yes." He said, "Well, as a matter of fact," and this is where things, he said, "I had a call from the divisional engineer last week." He said, "And we're so short-staffed." He said, "Asked me if I knew of anybody who was technically minded who might be interested in finding a job or having it." Ah, well, I jumped at the chance, and about 3 weeks later, he said, "Well, subject to you having a trade test," he said, "you're in as a temporary technician." I didn't care whether it was temporary or not.
So how old were you at this point? About 20 or so?
Yeah, 20. I was about 19 and a half or 20 or so. And he said, I'll organise it." I said, what is the trade test?" "Oh," he said, "you've got to install a telephone and a Watsy switch." I said, "Oh, well, I'd never seen the inside of a telephone, but I had a friend whose family had a telephone. So I got a screwdriver and I carefully undid the screw at the side, one of these old wool Maggie handsets, and had a look. And the way they drew circuits was a little bit different to what I was used to. And but I figured it out and I thought, oh, there's not much in there. And so came the great day. And I did this trade test in the bike shed of the post office. And I got there. He came and showed me what to do, what he wanted done. And he said, "I'm off now shopping with my wife. And I'll be back in about an hour." So I got to work and I put it in there and I measured to within a quarter of an inch the distance between where I put the staples. And I even finished up and I polished the lead-covered cable. Anyway, he came in and he took one look at it and he said, "Oh." He said, "Ah, you passed." And I said, "Oh, would you like me to, I suppose you want me to pull the whole thing down now?" He said, "Oh, no." He said, "I want to leave it there." He said, "I've got a young bloke here that's did his 5-year tech and training course." And he said, "I want him to see how a telephone should be installed." So that sort of boosted my confidence a bit.
That's great, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, anyway, I passed all the exams, the techs exam and the senior techs exam. And around about that time, he was looking to go back to Perth or go to Perth. And by this time, my father and mother had decided that they were going to live in Perth. And Dad said, Oh, if you want the house, you can have it for what I paid for. I said, oh, yeah, okay. So that happened. And then when Arthur Tresidder, he was the best boss I ever had, I think, he came to me and said, oh, we'd go off to Perth. He said, they're transferring me to Perth. And I said, oh, God, what's going to happen about the job? He said, oh, they'll advertise it. By this time I was a senior tech. He said, you ought to apply for it. I thought, I'd only been in the job 5 years. And he said, well, go on. He said, there's nothing stopping you. So I applied for it. And I got the provisional promotion. And so 5 years after I joined the PMG, I was the bloke that was on the other side of the fence. I had a wife, two children, and I had my ham license. But my triumph was short-lived because in those days everything was done on your seniority number.
Oh, yes.
And if you were one less than me and you applied for the same job, whether you were good, bad or indifferent, you sort of automatically, you know, got to the front.
Mm.
And that's what happened. And then after that, I was going to be sent to a place called Northam. I was pretty disappointed about missing out on the job. I just got the title deeds to the house, and things were looking on the up. Anyway, one of the other guys, in the office said, hey, have you seen the latest Gazette? And I said, no. Didn't read the Gazette because I knew my seniority was so low. I was the most junior senior, in the Commonwealth rather than... Anyway, he said, oh, they're advertising for short-term temporary transfers to central office in Melbourne. Oh, I said, oh, yeah. He said, it's a lab. And my ears pricked up, and I said, what sort of a lab? He said, oh, it just said here, circuit equipment. He said, go on. You always like tinkering with stuff. So I put in a half a page application. And I still don't know why, but they picked me, and I went to Melbourne. That was a big jump from Meriden to Melbourne.
Gee. In Meriden, was it a step exchange or was it all manual in those days?
It was all manual. They eventually had one RAX rural automatic exchange installed, and I was very interested in that because I didn't know anything about this bimotional equipment. I arrived in Melbourne and started working the first morning. And one of the engineers came out and he had this hand-drawn circuit diagram. And I wasn't used to looking at rough hand-drawn circuits. And I thought, oh, well, they all mean the same.
Mm.
And the idea was that they'd come out with a circuit. And somebody would have suggested a modification. And then they would put a balloon with an arrow pointing to the point where the modification had to be done or made. Mm. And he waffled on there for a while and he said, it's a line finder thing and we want you to do this and this and that. And I said, oh, what's a line finder? He said, a line finder? He said, And he said, what do you mean? I said, what's a line finder? He said, don't you know anything about automatic equipment? I said, oh, I walked through an automatic exchange for a day when I first started with the PMG. They took me down and gave me a week's training. And the expression he had on his face was, having just swallowed half an apple, he looked at the other half that he was holding in his hand, and there was a half a worm sitting in there. He said, huh? I said, Oh, don't worry about it. She'll be right. And it was okay. And but it was a very interesting job because I could go on for hours, but the big chief was a man called Gilbert Hyde, and he was from Cambridge, I think, and he wore the, what was the name of it? Not the bowler hat, but there was another hat that businessmen always wore, a hard top, and yellow gloves, and he was, you know, the absolute epitome of an Englishman. Never call anybody by their surname. It was always Westbrook or whoever. And anyway, I'm spending too much time talking to you, but he found out I knew a little bit about electronic circuits. And I don't know what led up to it, but he wanted me to build a power supply, and he nominated the valve, and he said, off you go and do it, well, whatever you say. And I looked at the valve and I thought, no, this isn't any good. It was absolutely unsuitable. And so I went to the supervisor of the lab, and I said, his name was Kevin. I said, hey, Kev, this valve won't work because it's unsuitable. And he said, oh, he said, well, Gilbert chose it, and he should know. And he said, I said, well, it will not work. So I explained the reason. He said, oh, well, you better come and we'll talk to Gilbert about it. So Gilbert nominated the time. It was 9 o'clock. And we stood outside his door until the big hand pointed to the 12 and the other hand, little hand pointed to 9, and then we knocked, because if we'd knocked earlier or later, we'd have been rollicked. He was such a martinet, you know. And we walked in and he said, yes, Westbrook, what's all this about, you see? And I said, I don't think that this valve is going to work, Mr. Hyde. He said, oh. He said, why? And I started to explain to him. And then he tied me up in knots. And then eventually he said, Westbrook, go on. Get out of here. He said, unless you've got better reasons for than what you've just given me, I don't want to hear about it anymore. You know, and he really gave me a rollicking. So that got my ginger up, and I spent a few nights at home going through, and I drew load lines and worked out the currents and, oh, you know, everything, even about the quality of the ink I drew the circuit on. And it took about 3 weeks, but I said, I'm ready to go into Gilbert again about this valve. And Kev said to me, you better be sure, he said, if he shoots you down in flames, you're done. And I said, no, I'm pretty positive. So I went in there, shaking a bit inside, but determined to hold my own. Well, off we went, and we locked toe to toe there for about an hour. And then he finally could see he was losing. And then he started to draw red herrings across the circuit. What's this for, Westbrook? What does that do? Oh, no, it hasn't got anything to do with the operation of the valve. Mr. Hyde does this and so on. Oh, what is this over here? What? And finally, he looked at me and he gave me a toothless smile and he said, well, it looks like we have the wrong tube, doesn't it, Westbrook? I said, yes, Mr. Hyde. He said, well, what would you suggest? So I'd already worked out what I said, oh, such and such a... He said, well, you better do it, Westbrook. And off I went, and I made it, and I worked, and so on and so forth. But then we got on to building. He gave me all kinds of jobs and from then on, and more on the electronic side than on the mechanical ups and downs. And... But the main thing was that he came up with the first prototype, or an idea for the first prototype of the substrunk dialing timing mechanism. As you probably know, that in those days you picked up the phone, and when the person that you dialed at the other end answered, it just clicked the meter over once, and it was threepence a call or whatever it was. But when you tried to go, you know, a further radial distance, then of course the cost increased. And so this, all it was a digital series of relays, 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, some on. And they then just picked out the distance, got the correct number of pulses. That was the idea. But he designed the turrets, and there was 40 valves in the chassis, and we had to build the chassis. Then the lab, you did everything, you know, from winding the relay coils to exact specification, to making the tinware, well, the aluminiumware, and punch the holes. And these chassis were quite large. They fit inside a 3-foot, 6.5-inch rack. And there were 46 J6 tubes in it. And he would come out with a circuit, which might be a divide by two or divide by four or whatever. And he'd say, build it, you see. So we'd build it. And then we put it all together. And there was another guy working on it, but I was the first to succeed. And so everybody gathered around this marvel of modern science, turned the switch on, and away it went. And it worked perfectly for about 20 seconds or something like that. And then it stopped. And of course, we started looking for faults and things like that. And all of a sudden, there was its own volition. It started up again. And it would go tick here and a tick there and a couple of ticks over there. And it was totally random. And he was under a bit of pressure because he was so certain that the thing was going to work that he had invited all the state, what did they call them? Anyway, the engineers in general, or whatever their name was, to come and look at this marvelous thing. But we had five engineers at the lab, and everybody looked and couldn't work out what was going on. And they'd even got to the stage where they were considering putting in a manually operated one where somebody was sitting in the background operating the relays. Because, you know, the invitation had been made, and they were coming in about 2 or 3 weeks, and so poor old Gilbert was under a degree of pressure. So anyway, I thought, there's something common in this thing. And I went home and I read a bit more, and I thought, yes, there's no isolation between any of the circuits as regards the power supply was. So when the relay operated, it drew quite a bit more current, and so it dropped the line voltage, or the high tension voltage, and that was what was causing it. If you got two relays trying to operate at the same time, then it was a disaster. And I said to my wife, I said, I want to go into the lab early tomorrow, and I've got an idea that I can fix this. So I went in and put in some isolating resistors, turned the bloody thing on, and away it went. And it ticked away there quite nicely. And I went to the supervisor and said, I think I've fixed this. And he came out and he said, oh, this is great. Let's go and get Gilbert and the other guys. You see, and they came out and gathered around. And Gilbert said, and what was the problem, Westbrook? Well, I said, we should have isolated each tube from the power supply. Oh, he said. And then he just said, okay, build it. Turned on the chill and went off. He didn't even say good work or anything like that. Anyway, but from then on, I, at the end, I picked up, I became a supervising technician back in Western Australia and held the job. And it was my turn, the 12 months was up. And he called me in the office. He said, oh, and you're leaving us, Westbrook. I said, oh, yes, Mr. Hyde. He said, how would you like to stay on the lab? And I said, oh, I'd love to, Mr. Hyde, but my position, I'm now a supervising technician, equal to the supervisor of the lab. And, you know, he is the supervisor. And he said, and what would make you interested in staying? And I thought, oh, well, might as well shoot as high as you can. I said, oh, grade two supervising tech would be all right. And he said, oh. Thought for a while, and he said, these things can be arranged, Westbrook. And I knew how long that the public service made up their minds and the probability of success wasn't terribly high. And I said, show me, Mr. Hyde. And he said, oh, well. But the interesting thing was, I got back to Perth, and while I was working in the lab, the engineers used to come over from each state. They'd all be there, and they'd be looking at the latest improvements or the latest developments or what have you, see. And the one guy from Western Australia, he was a really a very blunt person, and he smoked a meerschaum pipe. And when he kicked you in the backside, you knew you were being praised, but if he said in nice words to you, you thought, oh, God, what have I done wrong now? But he was a straight-shooting sort of a bloke. He said, oh, look, Kev, I'm thinking of starting up a little lab of my own in Western Australia. Would you be interested in that? Oh, I said, oh, yes, yes, I'd be interested in that. But from the time he started talking about it to the time it was nearly for me ready to go back, I'd become a super tech. And so I contacted him and I said, Mr. Herder, I'm now a supervising tech. Oh, he said, He said, it'll take a while before I get the lab up to that level. He said, He said, would you be happy to come to Perth and work for us? I said, oh, I didn't care. I didn't particularly want to go and live in Perth. And I had a nice little station down at a place called Donnybrook in southwest Australia. We were all excited about it. And anyway, when it came time, I finally said, well, what's happening? And he sent back a sheet of paper, a hand scrawled across the thing, better come to Perth, Kirk. That was my instructions. I thought, oh, well. I arrived in Perth and went into the office. And he puffed on his meerschaum pipe there for a while. He said, you don't know much about automatic telephone exchanges, do you? I said, no, Kirk, I've been in one, only one, since I joined. He said, well, he said, we're going to make you a supervising tech in charge of exchange installation team. My heart sank. I just wished the floor would swallow me up. I went in. He said, well, you go in and talk to a divisional engineer, or group engineer, rather. He said, and he'll tell you what's happening. So I finally found out that I was to take over, I think it was a 10 or 20,000 line upgrade to an old telephone exchange, and I was to take over from the guy who they were moving on to, or getting rid of him or something. And he said, off you go. Here's how you get there. He didn't even bother to take me out. And he said, just go there, catch the number 21 bus and get out there. And his name is so-and-so. So I went out and this guy was sitting there reading a newspaper. And I said, are you so-and-so? And he said, yep. I said, oh, I'm Kevin Westbrook. I've come to take over from you. Ah, he said, went on reading his paper. And I thought, oh, Jesus, this is it. And I looked around and, oh, dear, you wouldn't believe it. It was, in those days, we had to build our own racks and put in the inch and a quarter taps, quarter inch tap, I think that is, and to mount the shelves. Mm-hmm. And they were getting old shelves, buying old equipment and cutting it in halves, the shelves in halves, and they, because they just about fitted. And then we were reinstalling it. And it was stuff that had been in store for years, and they were just trying to save money. And anyway, I got there, and this guy was showed absolutely, he was totally disinterested. I said, well, where's the records? Over there in the box. Oh, yeah, okay. They had a camp stretcher, and I went and sat down, looking around. I didn't have a bloody clue what I was doing, why I was there. The engineer had given me a list of instructions, but I couldn't understand his handwriting. And I just wish that I was somewhere else, I tell you. That was the worst period of my life.
Yeah.
And to make matters worse, all the other, guys that were in charge, were doing the work, was knew that I knew very little about automatic telephony, and they would be working up on the runway, and one guy would say to the other, oh, do you know, I've got this problem, I don't know how to go about fixing it. Oh, ask Kev, he's the supervising tech. And there were times when I was ready to drag these guys down and give them the old 1-2 and the fist. I thought, keep you cool. In 6 weeks, I'll be listening. And in 6 weeks, they were. And I did quite a few jobs. And one of the most difficult jobs was a semi-auto truck exchange, which was, there were only two built in Australia. And they just gave me a filing cabinet full of drawings and said, it's all yours. So I had to learn it, and we lived up. Anyway, cut a short story long. It worked all right, and to reward me for all my hard work, they put me in the office, and that didn't excite me. And that's when I came to join the, my friend said, have you seen the latest Gazette? I said, never read them. And they said, well, they're looking for temporary transfers for people to go and work at a place called Mushay for something to do with man in space. I said, oh, yeah. So I wrote up an application, told them what I'd done, and said, I hereby apply for any job which you think the following qualifications are suitable. And posted it off, and they rang me. It took 6 weeks. My chief rang me and he said, you're going to Mushay. I said, oh, fair enough. He said, you know, and then we started talking about the arrangements that we had to make, you know, about taking a tool check and all that kind of stuff. And I said, well, and he said, the guy you ought to ring is Lewis Wainwright. He said, and make contact with him. And I said, oh. I said, what position did I get? Oh, I said, the senior technical officer, grade one, in charge of air-to-ground communication, ground communication, and time standards. And that was the equivalent of about a class four or a super diffusing tech, grade four, which I had no hope of ever reaching in the PMG. So I was quite excited about. I was more excited about the job than I was about the money. And that's how I came to go to Muirchbach.